This is Easy Chair number 416, August the 5th, 1998. This evening in the Easy Chair, Douglas Murray, Mark Rush Jr. and I will discuss books. Now, the question is from Ron Cassell in Bassett, Virginia. Discuss the history or 10 most significant books ever written concerning Christianity. That is, books every Christian should read. Please do not let your modesty stop you from including those books of yours that should be on that list. Well, I am going to choose a little different topic. Not the 10 most important books, but 10 books that have been influential, that are good reading. Some may be great, some not so great, but they had an impact, and that can vary from person to person. I'm going to start with a rather obvious choice of a book that is a famous one, Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. It was written in prison where Bunyan was an inmate for, I believe, 13 years for unauthorized preaching. Now, we must remember that very few people in those days survived that long in prison. Bunyan survived because his jailer was sympathetic, and he would release Bunyan and say, you can take off, go to London or wherever you want to. Don't call attention to yourself, but be sure you're back here in 2 days or by the end of the week. So Bunyan was able to go here and there, borrow books, and live out of prison a fairly normal life a good deal of the time. Pilgrim's Progress is his best known work. I read it several times before I got into the university, and read it once at that time. It's a very simple book. When you read it, you don't fully appreciate its greatness. But what it does is to bring into perspective the fact that our life here is a religious and moral matter, that we are not to see it on any other terms. I was interested when I was a graduate student in talking with one brilliant graduate student who later went on to hold high places in various groups. And he, for the first time, because it was a great book and he was told it was important or had read that it was, he read it. And he said at first it seemed like a rather old, simplistic moral allegory. But he said the more I read it, the more I was deeply impressed by it, because what it drives home is what we tend to forget, namely that life is a religious and moral issue. Well, it was interesting that this man was anything but an Orthodox Christian. He was a very earnest and sincere person. He tried all his life in his own way to do good, but this is the impact that Pilgrim's Progress had on him. I don't know how widely Pilgrim's Progress is read now outside of Christian schools, Christian circles. But the importance of Pilgrim's Progress is precisely what he saw. It confronts you with the fact that life is essentially a pilgrimage from this world to either heaven or hell, that the basic decisions of life that you confront and the basic battles are moral and religious. And you must begin very, very early to recognize that fact or you are in trouble. So I strongly recommend to anyone Pilgrim's Progress to be read carefully. It may seem like one is reading a children's book, but it has over the generations commanded adult readers like Theodore Roosevelt and others who found it profoundly instructive in the fact that the moral and religious issues of life are always there and they are inescapable. We may blind ourselves to them, but we pay the consequences.
It's interesting. Somebody gave me an old book just because they knew I liked old books. That it had Pilgrim's Progress in it, but until I saw that old edition, I didn't realize that he wrote a sequel to Pilgrim's Progress, which is not as well known. I don't recall offhand whether
they
called it Book 2 or it was Part 2.
Has a somewhat different title.
Or a whole separate title, but it was the sequel to Pilgrim's Progress. People who are somewhat familiar with the book realize that very early he had to leave. He left his family on this pilgrimage, which represents his life. His family was left behind because they ridiculed him. And so he went through this life as a new Christian without his family, and representing a man who was converted but whose family wasn't converted. Well, in this sequel, it tells about the separate journey of his wife, and I think maybe his children, I'm not sure though, and her conversion. But I read Pilgrim's Progress when I was in sixth grade, and it had quite an influence on me. It's a very remarkable book. It's a hard book not to be influenced by and to see yourself in.
It's a masterpiece of simple writing. He knew the Bible from cover to cover and had absorbed its simplicity of language. Now, it is interesting that the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress have been credited with having a profound influence in literature, especially in this country. We have in the early 20th century in particular, developed a style of writing in fiction and elsewhere which is simple, not complicated, highfalutin, scholarly, as so much of the writing of the world is. And you can trace the influence of Bunyan and the King James Version in men as little Christian as Hemingway, a simplicity that became important in this country in particular because the Bible for generations played so important a part in everyday life and in the schools.
Something that's always interested me is the many of the books that you read as a child, and you remember them, and you have a perception about them from whenever you read them in sixth grade or seventh grade, and then later you read them in later years, and you see them in a whole different light. For instance, a political satire of like Gulliver's Travels and mm-hmm. the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And they're timeless because you can take a look around today and you see all these characters
yes.
Out there in society. And books like Charles Dickens that we read as children and then later realized that he was predicting the downfall of the British Empire into the depths of socialism, which they eventually fell into. So they it's sort of like a time machine, many of these
yes.
books.
Does anyone want to offer another book?
Well, another book that was often, it was one of the most commonly available books I remember reading, along with Pilgrim's Progress in Colonial America, the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Fox's Book of Martyrs, which I read, I think, a few years after I read Pilgrim's Progress. I think I was in high school, probably about a senior, when I read Fox's Book of Martyrs. And I didn't, it's basically an account of believers over the centuries from the early church to, I'm not sure when it ended, when it concluded.
16th century.
Who had given their lives for the faith. And I didn't have a particularly good grasp on history, and I could probably get a lot more out of it and understand a little bit more of the issues today. But what struck me is how many people over the centuries had taken their faith so seriously that they willingly suffered for it, even to the point of death.
Well, yeah, the inverse of that. The scientists who were willing to suffer the wrath of the church for going against the church's teachings on science at the time.
Fox's Book of Martyrs is still in print. We have to realize that the version we nowadays read is a condensation of a multi-volume original.
I just read that a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm. But it created martyrs because people read what simple people had done in other eras, stood up and died for their faith, and they therefore were impelled also to live without compromise. It has had a powerful impact. Any other books you'd like to suggest? Well, let me throw out another. It's a book I first read when I was an upper division university student. Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Now, it's not the easiest reading because Dostoevsky is a Russian, and just learning the names of the characters takes a bit of an effort for some people. But it's a very important book. It's a theologically governed book. It doesn't represent our Western Christian point of view, but a variation of Eastern Orthodox, or specifically Russian Orthodox, thinking. What Dostoevsky does in that book is to pose a commonplace problem, one often discussed and debated by students in his era, not only in Russia, but throughout Europe. It was in part created by a dissent and a disagreement with Christianity, a doubt of God, a doubt in the truth of the Bible. And the basic question was this: are we so brainwashed by religion that we no longer think rationally? If we did not have the brainwashing of the Christian faith, would we be troubled in conscience at all if we killed somebody? Or is our conscience a product of generations of religious training? Well, in Crime and Punishment, the hero, if you can call him that, the student Raskolnikov, is concerned with that question. He is convinced that conscience is a product of religion, that what one has to do is to demonstrate the truth of his belief by killing somebody. Killing somebody who should not be living, someone who's socially useless, no reason why they should be alive, they contribute nothing to society, and putting them to death should be seen as a socially useful task. So, this young student kills this elderly woman who deals with old used things, who has no real social function. He cannot find one redeeming feature in her life, so he kills her. But then, to his dismay, he finds that his conscience is troubled. Why? He rounds a corner and sees a police officer and he ducks. Why is he ducking? Why is he afraid of the police? Why does he have a troubled conscience? That's a myth. He goes over and over again the fact that I did no harm. If there be no God, this person's life or death has no meaning. It might even be considered a good act, getting rid of someone who is really worthless. So he debates this matter. In the process, he comes across a young woman, a prostitute, a rather weak person. She is a prostitute because she has a degenerate father, married to a rather weak but thoroughly good woman. He deliberately prostitutes his daughter to have the money to go on living, drinking, and doing whatever carousing he does. So the girl is unwillingly a prostitute, only because if she doesn't do it, her mother and others in the family will pay the price. Well, her faith comes to her rescue in this situation. And the faith that she has helps her out because it enables her to face up to a very simple and obvious fact. I am a sinner. I cannot excuse myself. I am doing that which is wrong. And all that can save me is the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ. Grace I do not deserve. And that's her faith. So when she meets Raskolnikov, they get into a discussion. And what she does is to witness to him, which annoys him no end. He's an intellectual. He's thoroughly philosophically well-grounded. He sees the basic issue. But she keeps coming back to what she believes is the basic issue. We are sinners. We are accountable to the Lord. We are saved only by grace, not by our thinking. And that's her witness to Raskolnikov over and over and over again. And it's powerful, because she is obviously very weak, but what she does is to cling to that very simple truth. Well, as it ends up, Raskolnikov becomes the target of suspicion. He confesses. He is sentenced to prison in Siberia. And before he leaves on the train, this girl prostitute comes to the train to give him a present, a copy of the Russian New Testament. Because there is his hope. There he will find the true answer. It's a powerful book, and really a great work, one of the great novels of the Western world.
What do you think of Shakespeare?
Shakespeare is an interesting person. I do believe, first of all, that he was Shakespeare, not somebody else, using a pseudonym. Second, there's a great deal in Shakespeare that we have forgotten or pay no attention to. His father was a fairly prominent Puritan of the day, and important in his community. So that the idea that Shakespeare was an ignorant man, how could an ignorant man produce those remarkable plays, does not hold water. He was well educated, and scholars have been able to find a remarkable number of citations from the Book of Common Prayer and from the King James Bible in his writings. He knew his faith. That alone was a remarkable education. Well, the plays he wrote were written for the London theater primarily, and they were written around themes that the court and the crown would approve of. And so you have a series of historical plays which exalted the monarchy, in particular the dynasty begun with Henry VII. Now, these were propaganda. They were necessary in part for survival. Henry VIII had taken over the crown from Richard III, who was vilified as well as killed, and presented by Shakespeare as a crippled hunchback. He was a very superior monarch, and he is suspected to this day of having murdered the two young princes who were the legitimate heir to the throne. He was next in line as a brother to the king. But Henry VII was not that close to the succession. Well, these historical plays were very good ones, not necessarily historical at all times, as with Richard III, who was deliberately vilified, so that to this day, very few people appreciate all that he did. Now, we have to realize, therefore, that we don't really get Shakespeare's perspective all the time. He's writing plays that the court is fully aware of, that either meet with court approval or there is trouble. So he chose themes, a lot of them from English history, in order to please the temper of the day and to get ahead. So Shakespeare's personal perspective is less an obvious one than that of most writers of the era who wrote for diverse audiences. Now, Bunyan paid a price for what he wrote, but those who were writing for the London theater were of a different caliber and less willing to pay the price, and would have paid it more directly and severely. Ben Jonson became virtually a member of the court with James coming to the throne, and he wrote everything that he could to flatter the monarchy, as did, of course, Shakespeare. But the writers for the theater were all of them concerned with making sure they did not offend anybody. The Puritan literature became unpopular as time went on, and it succeeded more and more. The earlier Puritan literature did not gain the same hostility as Bunyan's because it was not as widely read.
Do you regard the book Inherit the Wind about the Scopes trial in Tennessee? Was it distinctly an anti-Christian book?
I don't know that book. The trial was a grossly unfair one and has been misrepresented in that William Jennings Bryan is portrayed as a fool and Clarence Darrow as a hero. The media was entirely against Darrow. They did everything to ridicule him and hasten the old man's death. So that the Scopes trial has never had proper misrepresentation. The actual transcript of the trial gives us a very different picture. We often have a warped picture of history and of the books that have been prominent books, and very often some works for a time have been very, very popular and later disappeared from public view. The most popular writer of the Victorian era is not even known today. Not one person in 10,000 would know his name. Please turn your tape over at this time. I'd like to turn now to a book I think almost everyone who is over 40 or 50 has read, or younger if they've gone to a Christian school. Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. That's a wonderful story, rich in adventure and romance, history, very, very exciting to read. I read it again and again as a boy. It was excellent reading, and it was good reading. Now, many have said that this was a work which was a product of the Romantic movement. To a minor extent, that's true, but basically, what Sir Walter Scott did was to take a work from, or an episode, or an era in English history, create a fictional series of characters and events, all of which would be representative of their time, and yet would represent also Christendom. Scott was a moral and a devout man. His writings were always written to teach the reader. First, to teach him respect for the past. The idea that wisdom was born with us, and that until we were born, the world was stupid and crude, crass, and incapable of understanding anything. No. What he pointed out clearly was, times may have been grimmer, harder, but there were godly men, noble men, in bygone years, and we cannot afford to overlook that fact. God was able to work in the lives of these people and make them outstanding so that there could be heroism and nobility and good people in the Middle Ages, for example. Scott's works helped revive a respect for the medieval era, because there was much in that era to be respected. It's hard for us to realize that modern man, until such people as Scott gave them a different perspective, could live surrounded by the magnificent cathedrals of the medieval era and see no beauty in them. That is hard for us to imagine, but it was true. Well, Sir Walter Scott, in Ivanhoe, gives us characters that represent a high caliber, godly standards, and a way of life that represents a faith valid and effectual in any age, any era. Consider the fact, for example, that he has, as one of the most admirable and sympathetic characters, a Jewish girl, Rebecca. That was somewhat new in literature. Consider the fact again that he discusses people on both sides, even the bad guys, as it were, with a respect. They're not all bad. He sees them dedicated to a cause. So he gives us a fairly realistic view of people in all camps. The book left a mark on its age and on successive eras up until the early post-World War II era. It was quite extensively used in public schools. What has happened since, it has been dropped largely in public schools, but Christian schools have adopted it. And it is continuing to have a wholesome influence. This is an important fact, because literature is all important. From the 80s to about 1930 was the great age of massive writing of good literature for young people. Well, it was the earlier writers like Scott that laid the foundation for this. In this country, men like James Fenimore Cooper and one or two others. So the foundations were laid earlier in the previous century and flowered after 1880 to create a remarkable world of literature for young people. I'm very happy that there is a revival now of such writings. I think I've had a small part to play in it. The Henty Society and the Henty books, in this country at least, a good deal of it has been traceable to me. And one of the Washington newspapers, in an article in recent weeks, acknowledged that fact. That's wonderful. I'm glad to see that Douglas and Beverly Schmidt, Preston Speed Publications, good friends and good supporters of Chalcedon, have been republishing the Henty books. And one weekly magazine has a full-page ad every week of these Henty books, and they are selling in great numbers, which is good. It is interesting that at the same time, other able writers of the era are undergoing a revival. Jane Porter, for example, Scottish Cheves, and Thaddeus of Warsaw. My grandson Daniel regards Thaddeus of Warsaw as his favorite book. Well, one consequence has been that many are eagerly collecting these books that were very popular and were beginning to disappear, and in some used bookstores were periodically cleaned out and taken to the dump because they had no buyers. Right now, one of our group, Mike Pagani, has perhaps a few thousand such works, a marvelous library that his children are reading heavily in. So it is good to see this revival in the classics of boyhood reading. The revival is extended to some of the minor writings for boys and girls, like the Rover Boys and Tom Swift books, which were very, very popular when I was a boy.
How about the Horatio Alger books?
What?
Horatio Alger books.
I never cared much for them, but some of them have been revived.
In college courses in literature during the 1950s, professors held up the book Uncle Tom's Cabin as being the first American novel. Would you comment on its impact?
Which book?
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Oh, there were a number written before, but perhaps it was the most successful. Another, perhaps equally successful, was Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. Enormously successful.
What do you think of Twain?
I enjoy Twain. He was not a Christian. In fact, but for the restraint of his wife, would have been more openly anti-Christian. He poked fun at the faith constantly. However, he was closer to it than he realized because he was surrounded by it as a boy. When married, his wife, a devout Christian, went to church every Sunday, so Mark Twain did also. He took a trip abroad with his pastor. He went on a cruise with a company of passengers, all of whom were Christians. It was to see Christian places and things, Bible history and so on. And he wrote a book ridiculing them, but all the same, he was constantly under its influence, so more than he would acknowledge and realize, he was subjected to very thoroughly Christian influences. Mark, which of the older classics have you used in Christian schooling? I think it'd be interesting to know which ones. I think Ivanhoe you've used.
No, I didn't use Ivanhoe.
Well, someone did in the school.
I'm trying to think. I've used some of Robert Louis Stevenson's stuff. Treasure Island, of course, is a classic, probably the classic boys' adventure story. I've used some of Kipling's, like The Jungle Book, and what's the story about the Captain's Courageous? Was that
Kipling?
Kipling also, which is interesting because it's so very different. That amazed me about Kipling, the difference between The Jungle Books and something like Captain's Courageous would just, it's like it's two different authors. I didn't see any similarities in the style at all. Kipling took a great deal of effort with the Jungle Book, which is spoiled for many people because many people assume it's going to be like the Disney movie. Disney probably spoiled more people on the classics than any other single influence, because they'd take a very good children's story and make it into a silly cartoon, and usually destroying the story in the process. Also, something that's hurt a lot of the classics is the more recent movies, for instance, of the Jungle Book, which they feel necessary to make them politically correct. In fact, if you read the story of the Jungle Book, the basic thesis is there that this, of course, this boy is raised by wolves, but he realizes very early on, in fact, the other animals realize, and they try to tell him before he's old enough to understand that one day he'll rise above all the animals in the jungle. It's inevitable. He's a man, and he will rise above the animals, and he will be their master. And he doesn't realize that for a long time, but eventually that's what happens. In the more recent movie made about 5 years ago, which was beautifully filmed, but it was very politically correct, the tiger, who was the bad guy in the Kipling novel, the tiger was the wise one, and the jungle boy wanted to be like the tiger, and he wanted to learn from the tiger, and whereas Kipling said it was inevitable that man would rise above and man would have dominion, basically, without using the term, over the jungle and the animals, in the other, it's very more of an environmentally correct. Don't touch the animals. Leave the jungle animals as they are, and leave them alone. So it's too bad that movies have really spoiled a lot of the classics of literature.
Yes.
And a lot of novels aren't politically correct. Huckleberry Finn, for instance, is famous because it's been eliminated from a lot of public schools for using the N word. But actually, Twain was very rather affectionate towards blacks, more than probably most authors of his day. And the whole issue of Huckleberry Finn is about Jim and helping Jim to freedom. And Huckleberry Finn felt bad for doing it. He felt he was a terrible person for breaking the law and helping Jim get free. And of course, he had to make a simple fixed all that, because at the end, technically, Jim had been free the whole time, and so Huck hadn't really done anything wrong. But trying to think of some of the other names of the novels we've used.
Well, the movie studios have a fixed group of screenwriters that they know what they're going to say. You just don't write a screenplay anymore and send it in. There are no more, none of that. It's engineered. All of these movies are engineered from the beginning. The screenplays are approved by the studio, otherwise the movie doesn't get made.
That's why it's very hard to find any historical movie that's accurate.
There's a third book, of course, that deals with Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer Abroad.
I've never read that.
Oh, I enjoyed that. It deals with adventures in North Africa, but a fifth he wrote, or started to write, and it was Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn as older teenagers who were heading west to settle in the West. And what happens on the way is that a particular tribe of Indians attacks the wagon train, and the beautiful young girl that Tom Sawyer is in love with is captured. And at that point, the book ends, because Mark Twain realized he was trying to write about the boys when they were older and to be more realistic. And this was the kind of thing that happened. This was a particular tribe that was vicious in its treatment of prisoners. Some were kindly, some were vicious. And the likelihood is that the girl would be raped until dead. And suddenly, Mark Twain found him face to face in the course of a book he was writing that began innocently enough to be another adventurous story, face to face with original sin and depravity. And he couldn't go any further.
Well, there's a huge difference between Tom Sawyer even and Huckleberry Finn. Tom Sawyer is basically just a fun book of two young boys and their adventures one summer. Huckleberry Finn deals with the issue of slavery and Jim being separated from his family, and then they meet up with the con men who take advantage of Jim and Huck for a lengthy period of time. He falls in, I forget the name of the family that he falls in with for a time, and their son ends up getting killed in a feud. There's a lot more negativity even in Huckleberry Finn than in the one. A book you've mentioned that you liked of Twain's that I didn't like was A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. It was a cute story, but what I didn't like is I didn't like Twain, the main character's attitude was so cocky and arrogant that I felt that kind of detracted from, that was so overwhelming, his cockiness and his arrogance. Of course, the character later came to enjoy his time there, and at the end of the book, when he was home again, he was very, reminiscing quite a bit about missing it.
That book is interesting also in that Mark Twain had a rather confused view of the past, both pro and con. He flip-flopped back and forth. In Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, he ridicules the ignorance, the stupidity, the backwardness of the people in that era. So the Yankee is always calling attention to things that are backward. On the other hand, he was more than a romantic in his view of some aspects of the medieval era. He wrote a biography of Joan of Arc, which is the most romantic and sentimental account imaginable. He thoroughly fell in love with Joan of Arc, and she comes out glowing. She is so superior. So Twain was strange in that respect.
What do you think of Joan of Arc?
Of Joan of Arc?
Yeah, Joan of Arc.
Well, that's a hard decision to make. I've read and reread a number of works about her. She may have been part pagan in her origin. Her thinking may have blended both Christian thinking and a great deal of the rural surviving pagan thinking. Now, when she was tried, it was under suspicion of this paganism. However, there was enough in her of Christianity that she was also genuine at that point. In other words, in the rural and backward eras, where paganism and their Christianity had tended to blend, so that they believed both at the same time. I think that's very likely in Joan of Arc. She uses expressions that are more common to older semi-pagan thinking. At the same time, there is no denying there was a genuine awareness of the Christian faith. So it's a complex situation. One scholar who's very well versed in the survivals of paganism in the late Middle Ages wrote a series of studies, three volumes in all. The God of the Witches is one title, and I forget the other two titles. And she held to this thesis about Joan of Arc, as well as some other figures of the era. Now, her works were very savagely critiqued by scholars when they first came out early in this century. However, I noticed in the past few years, at least one has been reprinted and treated with respect. So there's no final word on the subject.
How do you regard Solzhenitsyn, the Russian author Solzhenitsyn?
I have read his autobiography. It's a great work. He's a very remarkable man. I am not familiar with the novels, but some of the shorter essays I've read also, tremendously moved by them. I wish I knew more of what has happened to him since his return. All I've heard is he's been treated with contempt by the people in Russia as an old-fashioned, out-of-date figure. That's very sad. He's there working out of a passionate desire to restore Christianity to Russia. I wish we knew more of what was happening to him now. Well, our time is about up. I don't know about all of you, but I've certainly enjoyed discussing these works. There are many, many like them that we should discuss, but it's been fun dealing with those we have dealt with. Thank you all for listening, and God bless you, and keep your questions coming.